we talk so much about representation and media, and we really don't, we stop there, right? And what I want us to talk about is production, right? It's about who's behind the camera, who's behind the mic, who's has the authority to write these stories and narratives. And I think that what this shows us is that we've always fought for creating our own content, and we've done it and we've been successful at it. Whether or not you know about it is a different story.
Welcome to Radio Survivor. We're here for the love of radio and sound. I'm Jennifer Waits.
Hello, everybody. Erica Klein here.
On the show today, we're taking a close look at the history of an influential Spanish language community radio station, KDNA. Located in Washington State, the station launched in 1979 and serves a rural community, which includes farm workers and immigrants. Our guest, Monica De La Torre, is assistant professor at the School of Transborder Studies at Arizona State University and is the author of a forthcoming book about KDNA called Feminista Frequencies, Community Building Through Radio in the Yakima Valley. Thanks for being with us today, Monica.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for having me.
So I'm curious, your book focuses on KDNA, and I'm curious what drew you to this particular station as a project.
Great. So I first became enamored by radio just through my own family and growing up. It was a point of relationship building with my mom, driving in the car with her, driving to school. We always listened to the radio, usually like top 40 Spanish or top 40 English radio. But once I got to grad school, I learned about this radio station called KDNA that was one of the first Spanish community-based radio stations in the country, and that there was a woman that was one of the first station managers at the station who was Mexican-American or Chicana, just like me. And when I learned about her, I got really excited because I had my own background in radio before coming to grad school. So I, one, was surprised and disappointed that I didn't know about this like radio past, that I had these, you know, foremothers that were on the radio before I even was alive, right? And so learning about radio from a woman's point of view, from an immigrant point of view, from the perspective of these marginalized communities was just something that caught my attention. And I started doing, you know, at this point already, you know, Google searches and just coming up short, not having any sort of information. And so that was my first dip into thinking about radio and thinking about Spanish language radio in particular and community radio and those different junctures. And again, really not finding a lot of research, and then thinking, well, you know, there's not a lot of research, so this is a perfect research project, not really thinking that it would, you know, also lend itself to a lot of challenges. But that was a really sort of serendipitous moment for me to come to grad school in Seattle and learn of this station, you know, far away from the Latino enclaves that we are familiar with.
Yeah. And before we get more into that, I'm always curious about people's personal radio backgrounds. And it sounds like learning about a station that had people like you was really compelling. Was that your experience when you were a participant in radio prior to that? And so tell us more about that story.
Yeah, maybe I'll finally divulge my missed opportunity in college radio. I went to undergrad at UC Davis, which has a pretty, you know, well-known college radio station, KDVS. And my roommate at the time and I went to the volunteer meeting and really just didn't feel like we didn't vibe. Like we just didn't feel that we were we felt that there was a sort of barrier to entry. We didn't feel cool enough. You know, I think coming along with that is that we were also first generation college students. You know, I come from, my parents are immigrants from Mexico, and I was the first to move away to college. So I think there was just a lot of newness in general in our lives that, you know, adding another layer of like the cool college radio factor just was not, you know, was not going to happen for me at that moment. I also just, you know, lacked in general, you know, self-confidence, was just an awkward, you know, teenager, right? And so really couldn't get into the door there, but always just had this dream that one day maybe I'll be on the radio. And I moved back to LA after that, after I finished my undergrad, and again, didn't know what I was going to do and started working at a nonprofit and then missed school and started a master's program where I came across a group of people that were volunteering at this radio station called KPFK, where they did a show once a month. The group is called Soul Rebel Radio. And they were like, we need volunteers. And it was such a different inviting experience versus, you know, before, where I felt like, you know, I don't fit in or it doesn't really feel welcoming. I had to do all these volunteer hours. Whereas these folks are like, we just need people to like help us make the show because, you know, we're all unpaid, young. You know, we really just want the access to the airwaves. To me was like, wow, they're letting you guys like be on the air for an hour. And it just seemed like a dream. And so I just started showing up to the meetings, and our first meeting, me and another new volunteer showed up and nobody was there. They were off to a party. So they forgot to tell the new people that they were like gathering at someone's home for their birthday party and their meeting was going to be there. But we eventually, having somebody else, you know, be new with me, we eventually stuck around and we were all self-taught. I learned to edit through watching the other people in the collective edit. You know, we had pirated copies of editing software. You know, we just like shared software, which you can't really do nowadays. I just dove into this love of storytelling through audio that I knew was there, but I really hadn't really cracked it open until I started working with this group.
And what kind of show were you doing there?
So we were doing a mix, like magazine style. We would do skits. So we had this format where we would pick a topic each month and sort of do a deep dive into a topic. So it ranged from like education to women's issues to the environment or war, the economy. And we would take the perspective of young people and do, you know, comedic skits or interviews or, and we always had two hosts that would kind of carry forward the show. And I think it just was my first also experience in collective media production, which it has its own, you know, variables and you're adding different types of people and personalities, but it was definitely a way to learn to make media that was group oriented, that was, we're all taking responsibility for this one project. We learned a lot about dynamics, about really getting our pieces done, learning how to write, learning how to record. Again, one of the nice things about a community radio station like KPFK was that we did have, once we were part of the collective, we did have, you know, access to the radio studio. So that really helped us to cultivate this weekly, you know, production meeting. We would go into the studios on Sundays and again, work on scripts and skits. And so it's kind of a hodgepodge, mishmash, but it was always very dynamic and very, I think, a way of helping us bridge into these other types of communities.
It's amazing and powerful that you found this community that was so welcoming. And I'm guessing that when you learned about KDNA, it rang true with that experience that you had at KPFK. So let's dive into what sort of station is KDNA and give that context of what the station is all about.
KDNA is a rural Spanish language farm worker focused radio station. It began as a collaboration between different civil rights, farm worker activist groups in the state of Washington, but also originally was conceived as a tri-state model that would bridge radio, you know, programming from Washington to Oregon and to Idaho. And so originally it was going to be, you know, this tri-state model that never fully formed. And Radio KDNA first actually started programming in Seattle at another community radio station, KRAB or Crab FM, which was Seattle's first community radio station. So people working on KDNA at the time on launching this Spanish language radio programming were really just looking for radio stations to air content. They really weren't looking to create their own radio station. But
and we're talking about this is around the time of the late 1970s, is that right?
Right. So this is like mid 70s, like around 1975, 76, the Radio Cadena project starts to create programming. And again, they're airing it at out of KRAB's SCA signal. So the secondary the subsidiary communications authorization signal, I think is what it's called. But it's basically another signal on the frequency that you need a special receiver for. So they bought about 150 receivers and were like renting them out. But you could imagine how that didn't become a very good model for getting radio to low-income communities, right? So they kind of like, the good thing is that they started doing these programs. You know, they started a news network called the Spanish Language News Network, where they had a, you know, a reel-to-reel phone recording set up, and they would have reporters from across the country call in and record short news segments in Spanish. So this was around like 76, 77, 78 that this like short-lived news network happened. But again, it's just was showing the connectivity of these communities, showing sort of an underground, because we don't really learn about or talk about, you know, Spanish language network as much as English networks, right, in the U.S. So, but it created this like network of pockets of reporters that knew that they could now call into KDNA and record news for Spanish speaking communities. So that sort of set up the people working on the project to then apply for a FCC license. So they knew that the window was closing soon for community nonprofit radio stations. So they just got in their application in time. And that sort of started this new journey of building a radio station, but not in Seattle, in Granger in Eastern Washington, which made a lot more sense in terms of it being in a rural area. I think it really set up the station for some benefits in the sense that there is more availability in radio frequency. There was, I mean, also the community they wanted to reach, the listeners were in that region, right? It's a mostly agricultural area. If you haven't been or aren't familiar with Central and Eastern Washington, it's a lot more, you know, the climate is a lot more, you know, both really cold, but also really hot, dry and arid. So a lot of irrigation programs were started in the 40s and 50s that really laid out the conditions for a lot of migrant Mexican and Mexican American farm workers to start coming from places like Texas and Arizona and California and across the country, really, to the Yakima Valley to start working in hops or cherries or sugar beets. So it's also a big crop. So the radio station really did do its job of coming to the listeners that they were really trying to cater to. But it's in a very rural area. The station first set up shop in an old building that was called the Academy. And it had a sort of life of its own. It's an old three-story brick building that was a hotel in the early 1900s for the trip from Spokane to Seattle. It was kind of like a halfway point. It then became a Seventh-day Adventist church. And then eventually it became sort of like a social services hub where nonprofit groups that helped start the station were housed there. So one of those groups was the Northwest Rural Opportunities. That was for migrant help for migrant farm workers, employment opportunities. And so they helped sort of set up the station in this old building and really just converted, old offices into studio space. But really, I guess, humble beginnings, like a lot of community stations, you know, there's secondhand equipment. It's, again, you're doing a lot of stuff, DIY, or what I call in the book, rascuache, which is a Chicana or Chicano term that means like, you know, also like do it yourself, or you sort of make means with whatever you have. But within that, you are able to make a lot of actually really great media, right? It's not so much about sometimes the equipment, but it's about the narratives, the stories that get told through that.
I was struck by, well, from the very beginning of the conversation, you talked about how powerful it was to you that a woman was one of the folks behind KDNA from the beginning, and your book is called Feminista Frequencies. So I'm curious to have you talk more about why you specifically wanted to focus on women's role at the station and their part in its history.
Well, I think first of all, media still continues to be perceived as a very male dominated. But what I think I'm learning more and more as I do this work is that it's actually not the case. And there's been a lot of women from the early days of radio. And I know we know this a lot about, you know, English radio. But I think when we think about the history of Mexican American or Latinx communities in the U.S., we really are not given the chance to learn about people that innovated mediums like radio and television and film, right? We're very much cast in this immigrant, always immigrant and never as part of like an embedded part of the country, right? That has a history well beyond even the beginnings of this country, right? So I think to one, make a deliberate call out that this is going to be an engagement with media that's going to have a focus specifically not just on women, but on how that in and of itself creates a point of innovation that we're going to create media a little bit differently than other people, right? And any subjectivity, right? That you experience, any difference that you experience in your life, that's going to orient you in a different direction and influence how you produce, what you create, right? And so I think that for me, it's always interesting that we elevate a lot of men, especially in radio, especially I think with Spanish language radio, we are quick to sort of name a lot of famous male radio personalities like Pedro González and others, especially in the early days. But I think that there's just a larger story to be told. I think that men don't work in isolation. They don't work in a vacuum. Men often, we know, have partners that are women that have done a lot of the work without the credit. So I think that automatically signaling through this idea that women engage in a frequency and in a way of making radio that is connected across time and space, that for me to create radio in the 2000s, early, you know, mid 2000s, talking about, you know, women's issues and access to women's reproductive rights and talking still about sexism and machismo and were topics that were being discussed in the 70s and 80s on these shows. And I had no idea, right? I didn't learn about it, but yet we created the media in the same vein, right? To have references to our cultural traditions that are, again, I see it in their program guides. I see it in how we engaged in, civil rights, in the memory of civil rights activism of the 60s and 70s, you know, without knowing that there was also some media activism in there. So I think that for me, it's always figuring out a way to give credit to women, but also to say that the work can't just happen with women, right? It has to be a collaborative process that men also need to engage with. That, and I talk about some of that in the book, that while there was resistance, there was, you know, still sexism, that there was also allies and there were people that believed in the right for everyone to learn how to make media.
I think, I mean, again, back to the beginning, you talked a bit about spaces that felt welcoming to you or that didn't feel welcoming. And I think often, you know, from my own experience too, radio and technology can be sort of presumed to be a more male activity. And I think, you know, breaking down that myth is really important. And I get a sense that that's something that was going on at KDNA, where women were really encouraged to be producers as well, to do the hands-on work that people might think is sort of high tech.
Right. Yeah. They were just as much learning to cut the audio and to actually produce a full segment. And I think it was partly, you know, also out of necessity, right? It's like, you have to fill about 18 hours a day of radio. That's a lot of content, right? And so I think part of, again, being set up in a way that's, you know, do it yourself and like, let's just figure all that out on our own. Those also create some really interesting conditions for, you know, really anyone stepping up and saying, you know, I want to learn, I want to do this. And I think once people are allowed to engage in that creative process, then everyone enjoys the results, right? And so I think that was something really important for KDNA, but also again, that the station manager was the woman that really made space, you know, to also hire women at all capacities, right? So I think that again is just a really important piece of that puzzle.
What was the name of the station manager of this Yakima, Washington radio station in the late 1970s?
Yeah, so her name, Rosa Ramon, and actually she's been the person that I've been working with this whole time. So I really need to give her not just a shout out, but also just really give her her proper credit in terms of being a co-collaborator in this process with me. So I met her here in Seattle at the University of Washington, working on another project called Women Who Rock, Making Scenes, Building Communities. And it is a project that's being led out of the University of Washington, but that really looks at bringing women more into the archives and into the history books of their roles in rock music, but also other music and social justice scenes. So shout out to that group. But I interviewed her for that project. And again, just another layer of connectivity and of relationship building, because that's also something that is part of this Feminista Frequencies, is that part of this work of documenting, especially radio, and especially radio from the 60s, 70s, 80s, now even 90s, right, is that a lot of these archives are not in the libraries at the university, right? They are in people's garages, in their basements, in their personal collections, and these personal collections mean something, right? And so meeting Rosa and then really starting to build a relationship with her, and I think my own background in radio helped, right? That she was able to not just see me as a researcher, but also as a fellow community radio person, right? That I wasn't going to just be extractive of knowledge and, you know, interview her once and then say, bye, thanks, you know, I'm going to go make my academic career now. But it's really been more of a just learning to be in community with her, with other people she's introduced me to, you know, still keeping that relationship going. And I think that all of those components just are, again, they are tactics that again, are very much feminist, but also just for any person that really wants to build community, right? So her and I have really done a lot of work in finding and digitizing and scanning, and she's just as much invested in this as I am. And I think that's also really important, right? So I think a lot of this work doesn't happen in isolation. It happens by making those efforts, building that community and being invested in getting this information out.
What was something that Rosa Ramon wanted people to know about her radio station?
I mean, I think just to know that it exists, right? I think that there's a lot of misconception about what role we've had and what legacy, what institutional building we've contributed to. And I think being at the forefront of public broadcasting is one of those things, right? That what we've used this medium, that farm workers at Spanish speaking communities have used this medium to really build community, to learn, you know, information and just to hear their language, right? To hear that. I think that's the biggest for her is to that the station, that its history and its role, it doesn't get erased or sort of sidetracked even more.
Right, because there's it's a farm worker radio station that was on the air in outside of any of the big cities in the United States. You know, it's far from Seattle, Washington, far from Spokane, Washington, and was on the air for decades.
It's still on the air now. Yeah.
And so broadcasting in the Spanish language, so I could see how it would fall through the cracks of the media imagination, you know, in the big city.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the, not just with radio, but with all formats with media that, one, I think it tries to homogenize, right? And tries to slap one label on communities. It's like, that's Black, that's Asian, that's Latinx, that's queer. But those are all, you know, they all flow through each other, right? And those are all just ways of, I think, sometimes building community, but also of keeping us apart and of not really seeing how Spanish is part of U.S. culture, right? As much as a lot of people don't want to admit it, you know, it's not, we don't have an official language, so it might as well be Spanglish and the other languages and hodgepodge and mishmashes that, you know, that is language. But you're absolutely right. I think it's easy for it to fall off the radar because we're not even on the radar sometimes, you know.
And well, maybe that's a good place to talk about the community of listeners. And was this unusual at the time to have a station anywhere that was broadcasting to farm workers, for example?
I mean, I don't think it was that unusual. I think that having it be so outwardly catered to, because I think, you know, workers in general have always, you know, taken to radio because it's something that they can listen to on the job, right? So I think even with Spanish commercial radio and like the 30s and 40s and 50s, there were pockets of music and, broker time that DJs were able to buy, you know, small half an hour at usually really bad times, right? Early morning, late at night. But I think that what community radio in particular, public broadcasting did is that it allowed for even more variety, right? That a bunch of, because it wasn't just KDNA that was started, there are a lot of others. So KBBF, again, is one of the first bilingual stations in the US in Santa Rosa. And then there's KUBO and went on air in 1980 in Denver, Colorado. KRZA went on air in 85 in Alamosa, Colorado. And there's a whole others that did go on air, and some have gone off air since. But I think that for a moment there was, you know, pockets of community broadcasting that, again, because we haven't archived any of this, it really hasn't been researched. We really don't know what other, I haven't even talked about the East Coast, which I'm not even familiar with, and all the Puerto Rican, Dominican, Cuban, right, that pockets of radio media production that, you know, that we still have yet to discover. So there's always, I think, been some form of Spanish radio, but a real commitment to rural farm workers and intentional creation of content for them, I think, was at the time pretty innovative.
And was the content talk content or music content?
It was everything. So it was morning usually started with music, usually with upbeat Mexican rancheras, you know, to kind of get people pumped for the day. Then they would go into talk. They actually also had a children's program called El Jardín de los Niños or Kindergarten that had like characters, and it was still on air and very beloved by all sort of children of all ages is what they say. They also had job opportunities, sort of like an on-air Craigslist sort of, where they would like sell things on air or trade, but just a lot of different focused on what the community needs were.
Another thing that you have pointed out is the activists, that there are activist roots and activists involved in founding the station. So I'm curious how that is articulated on the air.
Right. So I think two examples, one being in 1986, so maybe, you know, like almost 5-6 years into the station going on air, we have the passing of the Immigration Reform and Control Act, IRCA, the last time we had immigration reform. And so they helped people fill out forms, invited people to the radio station and said, hey, we're going to help you fill out these forms, letting people know that this was an opportunity. So I think that that, you know, is one example. The second is their health programming that they took on. So in 1989, they produced Spanish language radio drama, a radio novela, about three farm workers who are coming to the United States and encounter the AIDS epidemic. And so they talked about AIDS, about sexual disease transmission on air. They also had an accompanying fotonovela, or you know, like a zine or photo book. And they had, it was a 15 episode, about 5 minutes. But really, this is some of the content that I've uncovered through this work. And it's a really fascinating show. Again, 15 episodes, 5 minutes, three men, and they each play the sort of like a character role of the bad one, the good one, and the one that's figuring it out. But it really talks about, you know, deep, demystifying how one, you know, gets AIDS, what it is. Yeah, at that point, 89, right? It's still kind of, what is it? What's going on? A lot of misconceptions, a lot of talk about it being a gay disease, a white disease. And so it takes on this really taboo topic, and to much of the, you know, both celebration, but also dismay of community. And it didn't just air at KDNA, it actually aired nationally too. Mm. So.
Wow. Yeah. What was some of the I mean, that sounds incredible. And you know, yeah. I have a number of questions. You know, are we able to hear that anywhere? Hopefully, and what were reactions to it?
Yeah. So the reactions were varied, right? It was all from, this is amazing. Like, we actually need this sort of health education at farm worker camps, right? It's a community that's being very much affected by AIDS, HIV. There was also a lot of because the show is explicit, right? It talks about, you know, condom use and sexual activity and men engaging in sex with men. And people were not happy. They were, you know, this is too crude. This is too much. And so a lot of stations ended up either playing it really late. But, you know, I think in retrospect, that commitment to we're going to create this, even if it makes some of our listeners uncomfortable, because at the end of the day, it's about saving a life, right? I think that really speaks to the commitment to using radio as a tool for community improvement and knowledge and education. But hopefully, I'm also working on a companion website and podcast for the book. So hopefully you'll be able to hear the show on the archive, on the online archive I'm working on. So I'm hoping to bring a lot of the content that we've been able to find and digitize and put it up online, because I think at the end of the day, you know, this is not my knowledge, right? I don't want to hoard it. There's so much tendency, especially in academia, to, you know, say like, this is mine, can't have it. And I understand that, but I also, again, I want to stay true to my own community media roots. And if you don't share it, like, what's the point of it, right? So I'm really hoping that that all of these tools, right, the website, the book, the podcast, will just elevate sort of these stories and inspire, like, to figure out where other, you know, what other radio stations created by different communities are out there. Because I really do just, I know that there's just so much uncovered, you know, history out there. So I'm really hoping that this is just a little bit of a larger narrative.
Well, Monica De La Torre, assistant professor at the School of Transborder Studies at Arizona State University, when that website, when that book is available to the public, people will be able to find out about it at radiosurvivor.com, and perhaps we'll have you back on to celebrate.
Absolutely.
And the book is called Feminista Frequencies: Community Building Through Radio in the Yakima Valley. We're focusing today on Radio Survivor, in specifics on a radio station called KDNA in English, or Cadena in Espanol. And it was a farm worker radio station. How much union organizing, farm worker labor politics was on this radio station? Yeah. Was there an involvement directly with farm worker unions, or how did that
happen? Yeah. Yeah.
And
no,
we're talking about the 80s and 90s, and it's still on the air now, but we're also talking about the history of this station, which was founded in, it launched in 1979.
Yeah. So yeah, it's a great question. So actually, cadena means a chain link, or in Spanish. So it's also very appropriate in that it was trying to build, you know, power, I think, as well, and worker power, while not, I think, officially affiliated with any sort of particular union. The United Farm Workers, Cesar Chavez, did come and visit the station and was inspired to then launch his own network of radio stations, the Radio Campesina Network. And they had their own version. We have our own version, the United Farm Worker group here in Washington also organized, and was they were volunteers for the radio station as well. I think what the station really tried to do was to inform workers of their rights, inform workers of of the fact that they, you know, had the right to bathrooms and breaks and, you know, proper wages, and warning them that, you know, pesticides were, you know, dangerous and could cause illnesses. So I think that all of that, you know, we read it as pro-worker, you know, pro-worker and pro-union. And I think it very much is, but it's also just basic, you know, pro-human rights. And so I think that obviously the radio station, because it was for that specific community, was going to be challenged by structures like agribusinesses. So we do know that some, you know, big growers were a little upset about Radio Cadena, but, you know, they never violated any FCC, rules. And even though they, you know, try to catch them in sort of FCC violations to get them off air. When there were INS at the time, or ICE raids, immigration raids, the radio station did play a song, I've been told, to sort of warn farm workers that that ICE was around. So that's been a story I've heard shared about the station. But I think they were really just trying to you know, provide marginalized communities with resources that, one, were available to them by the government, right? But then I think also just letting people know that they were here for them, right? That they were going to be a source for information. You know, I've been told a lot of times that instead of 911, communities had Radio Cadena on speed dial, right? That they would call the station before they called the police or firefighters or any sort of authorities. It was always calling the station first. I think that speaks to the trust and the how much the station was able to become embedded in the community.
And who are the folks who are running the station, and who are the volunteers on the microphone, and were listeners becoming active participants in the station as producers? I'm curious about the broader community, like within and outside the station.
Yeah. So from what I've gathered, and, you know, that's been something to talk to listeners has been a part of challenging, right? Especially for that time. But a lot of the DJs were, you know, just volunteers from the community itself, college students, young people, farm workers themselves. So because they collaborated with this organization that I mentioned earlier, Northwest Rural Opportunities, they were able to offer job training programs for farm workers to then transition into radio work. So a lot of the people on air were actually, you know, farm workers themselves. A lot of the women, there was a women's show called Mujer or Woman. And a lot of those women were former farm workers that then were able to transition into radio broadcasting work, and just people from the community that were interested in being on air. A lot of people also, they invited, you know, social workers and doctors and different members from the community to be interviewed as well. So I think it, like any community station, it's welcoming of whoever wants to make, you know, make radio and play records and play music.
That's really unique, though, because we're all familiar here at Radio Survivor with urban radio stations that run on volunteer labor. But I'm fascinated by the idea of this Yakima, Washington, farm worker focused Spanish language community radio station that was able to staff itself with volunteers.
They had a staff. They did have a staff, like I think at most like maybe five. Mm-hmm. But I cut off your question.
Oh no, that's great. So there's five paid staffers, and then there's this large unpaid staff that makes the radio every day throughout the decades that this station mm-hmm. is on the air, mm-hmm. including today. It's just it's really interesting to think about such a small town having that opportunity, as opposed to, you know, most radio stations that I'm familiar with that are volunteer run are in the big city.
Yeah, I mean, I think from the shows that I've listened to and I think it just becomes very familial. Like it becomes very, a lot of families. So Rosa Ramon that I've talked about, who was the first station manager, she, you know, her sisters, her brother would, you know, be volunteers. They would like staff the events whenever they had events. So I think like a lot of, you know, Latino families, we will pull in on our own to, you know, guilt them into helping us. But I think that there's just such a commitment to keeping the station and to knowing the value of it, right? Because I think when I've gone to the station and talked to the people there, they're very proud and they're very aware that theirs is a very unique place, right? So since 79, they actually have been able to move into a brand new building that they built over the same place. So they demolished the old building and through grants and, you know, fundraising, we're able to create this brand new, really beautiful community center structure that has both the radio station, but also meeting space. So I think that which is different from other, I think, community stations. We always had to be buzzed in at KPFK, right? We couldn't just walk in. Whereas here, you know, you literally can just walk in and walk into the station. And it's a very welcoming. And I think it maybe owes that to that small town rural, you know, we don't lock our doors sort of like, you know, just way of living.
That rings true with experiences I've had. I think, you know, in some ways, in smaller communities, a community radio station has a different sort of vitality. And like you talked about, really interconnected and part of the family.
Yeah. And it's generational too, right? Like I'll have people that'll be like, oh yeah. Like when I used to teach classes at UW in Seattle, my students would be like, oh yeah, my, you know, like I used to listen to that station. Like that's like my aunt works there. You know, it's just a very, I think, intergenerational experience.
I wanted to go back. You mentioned the show Mujer, the women's show. Maybe talk a little more about that, especially, you know, since women are such a big part of your story, part of your book project about the station.
Right. Yeah. So it was, along with all their other shows, it was a show that came out sort of through dialogue and talk about what does our community need. And one of those things was that we need to have a show specifically dedicated to women, to women's issues. So it was a 30-minute show that covered, you know, different everything and anything. So they had cooking segments, they had like I said, different types of social workers and music. I have been able to track down one show. They interviewed a drummer for this local group who's a woman drummer. And they also, you know, again, bridging those difficult topics, had talked about sexual assault and incest. And that was one of the shows that I was told in my interviews was really impactful, and actually just mentioning, you know, that topic on air really allowed for people to just call in and really share and start talking about these really, you know, damaging and hurtful experiences. But I think that's one of the really beautiful things about radio, is that it does give that anonymity, but also that intimacy, right? That's what The Voice really lends itself to, is that people are able to call in sort of not the best conditions and seek guidance and seek help. Talking about domestic violence on air, a lot of women just hearing that story. I know one person I talked to shared with me, she was able to like leave her husband, and because they had this other show, the one I told you that they like the on-air Craigslist, she was able to get like the child seat, you know, through that, so that she could like leave her house and put her kid in the car. And it's just like all those little intricate, but also we don't really think about details of these situations are just all embedded through the radio. And I think that giving just that space to women to do with what they wanted on the air just was really impactful. And again, created conditions for women to step out and be like, I deserve better. So yeah, I think those are some of the more powerful aspects of the radio station.
And you've mentioned at least one example of how influential the station was. Maybe talk a bit more about that. You know, it sounds like they were really doing some groundbreaking programming and projects. And how has that influenced other radio stations or other communities?
From what I've been able to gather, they did influence other stations. Like I said, that there was other Chicano community-based stations being founded at the time in the 70s and 80s. And they knew about Cadena. They had a policy that prohibited airing sexist music. So they wouldn't air any songs that were degrading to women or, you know, degrading to any people in the community. And like people knew about that. People knew that, oh, they don't play that kind of music at KDNA, or just learning about each other and their tactics for producing media, I think, was something that Cadena was influential in. All of the health programming. So like I said, that they had the HIV/AIDS show, they've had shows on breastfeeding and asthma. And I think really having content for Spanish speaking listeners is in and of itself, you know, just something we don't really think about when we think about health education content, right? How do we reach different types of communities? But I think that their impact has just been to locally within the community, just really inspire folks to, you know, go to college and to, you know, just learn that there's other options out there. So I know that that's been something that people have shared with me, that that the station really helped them to, you know, do better and go to school. And so that's, I think, influence that
Monica,
is really valuable.
Monica De La Torre, have you listened to the station KDNA during the pandemic? What kind of education, health, public health information are they broadcasting? Especially last year?
Yeah, I don't listen a lot to it, but I know that they were getting information out about, you know, first like COVID and what it was, and then now getting out, you know, the information about the vaccine. So it's still very much, and now they're working with a local health group called CMAR that, it, you know, I think is committed to informing different communities about both COVID and the vaccine. So, but they're still on air. They're still, I just listened to it this weekend. They're still playing music, sort of their regular programming, but interspersing, you know, public service announcements about washing your hands and, you know, all that we all heard early on in the pandemic. So they're definitely part of that, you know, that voice of getting information out to the community.
Right. And you know, here in the big city, in the middle of June 2021, the vaccine might be old news, but Yakima, Washington farm worker communities, Spanish language, right, community radio programming, there's a lot more urgency about getting vaccine information to the right people.
Yeah. And if people are still traveling for work, right? Like I know states have had different rollouts. So, you know, maybe in one place people aren't able to get it, but here they are. So I think it's just continues to be an important source of up-to-date information.
And earlier you talked about some of the work that was being done before the station was created had to do with creating news content that could be shared all over the country, right, really. Right. And did that continue after KDNA launched? Did they continue to create content for other stations could use?
And was this volunteer news?
I don't know if, I know that they did like have like other news producers call in. So they were probably hired, you know, employed through other news stations, but it didn't continue in that format once they were in Granger in the Yakima Valley. I think they started just broadcasting some of the NPR news, and then they started airing. So then NPR started producing a show called Enfoque Nacional, which was it ran from 1978 to 88, and it was NPR's only Spanish language radio program, but it was produced out of KPBS in San Diego. And so that was shared with KDNA. So a lot of these stations, shared programming, right? So KDNA shared some of their stuff. Like I said, they shared, they aired the AIDS HIV program, the Tres Hombres Sin Fronteras, Three Men Without Borders, and other shows to other stations. But from what I know of, the news network sort of went away once they came to Granger.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard in recent years from other stations about, in particular in California during the wildfires, that in emergencies, often it can be really difficult to get information in Spanish. And so stations that air either Spanish programming or bilingual programming are often having to translate press conferences on their own. And so I'm curious if that's something that I would imagine that is part of what KDNA does, is, you know, provide some of this information that might not otherwise be available in Spanish.
Yeah, well, one great example is in May of 1980, Mount St. Helens erupted here in Washington, and very close to the Yakima Valley. And so thankfully, KDNA was already on air. It was May of 80. They went on air in December of 79, and they were able to air in Spanish. You know, go to your homes, like, don't be out in the fields, like, there's been a volcanic eruption. You know, so just even having that example that they were able to have, you know, emergency broadcast services for Spanish speaking communities was life saving, right? Because had they not had the station on air, you know, that ash, the all of that, the harmful effects of that eruption was reaching, you know, the Yakima Valley. So it really did put the station, you know, in a good test to see if they could, you know, really fill that really important role of letting people know to go home and be safe.
And presumably radio, you know, these groups, people came together to want to found, they decided to found a radio station for a particular reason. Maybe talk about that a little bit, about why the medium of radio was what they chose versus, you know, television or a newspaper or you know, what have you.
Right. Well, absolutely. I think that the fact that radio is a lot more accessible, it's a lot more low cost to make and to replicate. They did try. There was a few attempts to do public television broadcasting, but again, the cost of producing television is just so much more. And so when you don't have any money, I think the radio becomes just such an invaluable tool. And also, it just was more practical for their audiences, right? That they knew that farm workers and other people working were going to be more likely to listen to the radio out in the fields, right, on their ways to work and or home, instead of going to pick up a newspaper, which some people couldn't read, or, you know, getting home and watching television, you're not going to do, you're tired from working in the field all day. So you got to get up early for the next day. So they really did capitalize on the beauty of this medium that is radio, that it's so portable, that it's, it really is something you can do while you're doing other things, right? You can listen and do other chores or work or leisure, right? That it really does lend itself to the different moments of your life and of your day.
And as we sort of wrap things up, maybe talk a little bit about some of your favorite finds in the archives, because it seems like you have uncovered a lot of interesting stories and details about the station.
Yeah, I mean, there's still a lot. There's so much. I think, you know, if I'm going to betray, I've talked so much about my love of audio that I'm going to say I love the pictures. But, you know, thankfully, Rosa she bought a camera early on, and just the visual archive is just so stunning. And I think because I'm just a audio radio geek at heart, that just seeing the old microphones and the setups and, you know, the converted stations, because it just takes me back, I think, to KPFK, and it doesn't look the same, but it kind of does. Like, it just has that feel of a, you know, so many people have come through these doors and marked their place in the studio in some way or another.
80s and fashions. You got all
exactly the fashion, the all of it, the hair. Yeah. So I think really finding a lot of the visual, the program guides, which a lot of them were like hand-drawn. And so all of that just like to me spoke to, I think, again, because of my background, and not to just give so much credit to being like a radio person, but, you know, I think it does just give us a different lens of analysis, right? That I think I'm just so grateful for as a scholar that I have this other way of thinking about media production, that I could see them drawing it. Like I could feel them when I used to sit in a 3 a.m. editing, right? Like I could just picture them, you know, at 2 a.m. drawing that program guide, right? And it's like, that comes through for me in the stuff that we've been able to find. But I think the few shows that I have, I think are definitely up there in terms of just listening to the voices, listening to the choices and in production, the music. That's so cheesy 80s background stuff. But, you know, it just really marks the time and place. And I think just having these treasures and, you know, accessible, and thankful that people have held on to their things and to their memories and to the importance of it, that they, that Rosa knew even in, you know, 78, 79, I'm going to buy a camera and I'm going to take a ton of pictures because this is something, right? It could have so easily been, you know, forgotten, you know, thing to do, but thankfully it wasn't. And I think now we're just able to look at it and really learn from it, because I think what I ultimately hope that the book does is that it has us talking about, we talk so much about representation and media, and we really don't, we stop there, right? And what I want us to talk about is production, right? It's about who's behind the camera, who's behind the mic, who's, has the authority to write these stories and narratives. And I think that what this shows us is that we've always fought for creating our own content, and we've done it and we've been successful at it. Whether or not you know about it is a different story. And so I think that I'm just really excited for people to learn where Granger, where Yakima is. Like, I think that's going to be just such a cool, you know, addition to the Mexican American experience here in the U.S. that we're everywhere, whether you like it or not. You know, it's our histories are embedded very much in this culture that we call, you know, America and U.S. And so I think that having the because, you know, we're so much about evidence and what's your, you know, what's the proof, that I'm really glad that I have these visual and audio pieces of evidence to share.
We're always on Radio Survivor trying to broaden our understanding of what radio is and what radio history is. So, Monica De La Torre, I'm so thankful that you came on the show to tell us more about KDNA and this important history. So thanks again.
Thank you all so much. I'm such a fan, and I just I'm really thankful that that you create the space and continue to broadcast in this medium, because anytime anybody says, "What radio? What's that?" I'm just like, "Bleh." It'll be around even after where all this other stuff is burned to the ground.
Our guest today was Monica De La Torre, assistant professor, School of Transborder Studies, Arizona State University, and author of the forthcoming book on the radio station KDNA, Feminista Frequencies, Community Building Through Radio in the Yakima Valley. Extensive show notes and links to everything discussed on today's episode can be found at radiosurvivor.com. This is episode number 302. To hear today's episode again, you can go to our website, radiosurvivor.com, where you can stream this podcast. You can also find it wherever you get your podcasts. You can subscribe to it for free. Radio Survivor is a listener and reader-supported enterprise. To find out how you can support the work, go to radiosurvivor.com/support. You can email us. Our email address is podcast@radiosurvivor.com. On behalf of Jennifer Waits, my name is Eric Klein. Thank you so much for listening.